Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today, we'll have news for you about the FEC fining former Congressman Duncan Hunter and his wife. Then, on Green Scene, hear how you can get free passes to California State Parks at your library. Plus, we'll have an update on the latest climate report and what that means for California. An arsonist in the Chase Bank burning in La Mesa during that 2020 riot has been sentenced, and we'll have details. Then on Crime Beat, hear about a daring escape by a prisoner from Grossmont Hospital in La Mesa. Now, if you've got Easter candy for your kids, listen up, because there's a recall on some chocolate Easter products due to salmonella. We'll tell you about events to celebrate Arab American History Month coming up at local community colleges, and how seniors can now get help with tech devices at the Oasis Center in La Mesa. Hear how Medicare recipients can get free COVID-19 tests, and why California's community colleges are seeking more students. There's a boil water notice up in Potrero at the county park. We'll have an update on Lemon Grove's efforts to reopen the recreation center, and on a bill by State Senator Brian Jones that's stalled in Sacramento, but aims to help keep sexually violent predators out of neighborhoods. From California News Service, we have a warning about charity scams related to Ukraine. And then from Public News Service, we'll have some national news headlines, including the Senate confirmation of Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, the first Black woman to hold the position, as well as the United Nations kicking Russia off of the Human Rights Commission. Today, we'll be replaying Sounds of History, an interview with Dick Pennock, the brakeman on the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum's historic train, as we look forward to Campo Day, coming up April 30th to bring history to life locally. On People Power, learn about the Campo Farm Animal Rescue Group, how you can help senior gleaners provide food to folks in need locally, and as the temperatures heat up, we'll have some wildfire preparedness tips for you. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
Nearly 6 years after it received a complaint about then-Congressman Duncan D. Hunter's suspicious spending, the Federal Election Commission has fined Hunter and his estranged wife, Margaret, $12,000 for illegally using campaign donors' money as a personal piggy bank. Margaret Hunter served as a campaign manager. In addition, Hunter's campaign treasurer was fined $4,000. The FEC reached the same conclusion as a federal criminal probe. After a grand jury indictment, Hunter was convicted in federal court on corruption charges. Margaret Hunter pleaded guilty to a single corruption count. Hunter was sentenced to prison and his wife to home confinement, but both were soon pardoned by President Donald Trump, sparing Hunter from serving prison time. The Hunters' lavish personal expenses, paid for with campaign donations according to prosecutors and the FEC, included vacations, jewelry, and tuition at their children's private school. Hunter was even accused of spending campaign money on trysts with multiple mistresses. Hunter, whose district included most of San Diego's East County, resigned his seat in Congress after his criminal conviction. Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington filed a complaint with the FEC. The FEC told CREW that ordinarily it would seek a far higher penalty of six figures, but since Hunter's campaign has nearly $40,000 in outstanding debts and only around $14,000 in cash on hand, the agency scaled back the fines. The fines were denounced by Duncan D. Hunter's father, former Congressman Duncan L. Hunter, who told the San Diego Union-Tribune, "This FEC decision clearly reflects that the criminal prosecution of Duncan was a political hit job." The senior Duncan Hunter provided legal representation for his son in the signed FEC agreement. Hunter Sr.'s law license was inactive for over 25 years, but he resumed active status in August of last year. The FEC, in announcing the fines, also released previously secret memos and letters, which revealed that the Hunters made not just a few, but rather hundreds of personal purchases over multiple reporting periods using campaign funds. The FEC probe concluded that the Hunters knew that this was illegal and continued using donors' money for personal spending, even after twice reimbursing their campaign for unauthorized expenses, and reimbursement was not made until after an FEC complaint was resolved. The FEC documents also reveal that the Hunters failed to fully reimburse the campaign for personal expenses, a shortfall of over $4,700, which they blamed on a math error. In addition, a series of mistaken cash withdrawals were made directly to Margaret Hunter, FEC investigators found. The Hunters also failed to provide investigators with Margaret Hunter's duties as a campaign manager, a salaried position. FEC lawyers explained that the Hunters were still on the hook for civil penalties despite having presidential pardons. Though Trump has pardoned civil offenses for General Michael Flynn and Sheriff Joe Arapio, he did not do so in Hunter's case, limiting the pardons to criminal convictions for the disgraced congressman and his wife. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Elijah McKee.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Green Scene Report. Starting in early April, California State Parks have begun distributing California State Library Parks passes to public libraries across the state for checkout by library patrons. The new pass will allow free vehicle day use entry at over 200 participating state parks. That includes the many here in San Diego County, such as Anza Borrego Desert, Old Town, Rancho Cuyamaca, Palomar Mountain, Torrey Pines, San Pasqual Battlefield, San Elijo, Cardiff, and South Carlsbad State Beaches, Silver Strand in Coronado, Borderfield, and Tijuana River Estuary State Parks. The pass is valid for entry of one vehicle with up to 9 people at participating state parks. As part of a 3-part pilot program, each library jurisdiction will receive at least 3 California State Library Parks Pass hang tags per branch, including mobile libraries. Park passes will enter circulation on a rolling basis throughout April and May for checkout by library patrons. Library users can contact their local library for more information. Library card holders will be able to check out the pass for the allotted number of days allowed by the library, then return the pass for others to use. Governor Gavin Newsom's wife, Jennifer, says spending time in nature is crucial to our mental health and well-being. We're lucky to have the largest state park system in the nation, and I'm thrilled to partner with California State Parks and the California State Library to help make those spaces more accessible to California families. With the California State Library Parks Pass, she says, anyone with a library card will be able to unlock the benefits and beauty of our majestic state parks. Research shows that spending time in the outdoors is associated with better mental and physical health, and that many Californians face barriers to such access. California has a wealth of state parks, and many public libraries are likely within driving distance of one. By reducing barriers to park access and partnering with entities such as libraries, the state can help more Californians explore the outdoors and generate positive impacts in health, natural resources stewardship, and historical and cultural connections. California has over 1,180 public libraries, and more than 23 million Californians already have library cards. These libraries already offer books, technology, Wi-Fi hotspots, videos, music, instruments, tools, telescopes, and host programs attended by tens of millions of Californians each year. And now, the California State Library Parks Pass program is one more way that Californians can get empowered through their libraries. In addition, the California State Library will be providing grants funding to libraries for outdoor-related items for checkout, programs that teach natural resource stewardship and outdoor skills, or to encourage library patrons to enjoy the outdoors and make historical or cultural connections to parks. A $9 million one-time general fund investment was included in the recent state budget to launch a state parks pilot to expand parks pass distribution, especially for youths in disadvantaged communities. The pilot includes the California State Park Adventure Pass program that provides free day-use passes for fourth graders and their families, the revamped Golden Bear Pass program, and the California State Library Parks Pass. You can learn more on the new California State Library Parks program at checkoutcastateparks.com. Again, that's checkoutcastateparks.com. And for information on all the other new Parks Pass programs, you can visit parks.ca.gov/California Outdoors for All. Again, that second one is parks.ca.gov/California Outdoors for All.
State and international reports on the effects of climate change are out this week. Government efforts to fight climate change must be sped up significantly if the world is to avoid the worst effects, from megafires and drought to sea level rise and floods. That's according to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's latest report, released Monday. The IPCC says countries need to cut carbon emissions by 43% in the next 8 years. Lauren Sanchez, senior climate advisor to Governor Gavin Newsom, says California is taking a whole-of-government approach.
The world's leading climate scientists have made it clear. Our window to avoid the worst impacts of the climate crisis is narrowing faster than expected, and success requires unprecedented collective effort and transformational change.
Also on Monday, leaders of a dozen state agencies detailed their roles in California's climate adaptation strategy, including in transportation, housing, agriculture, energy policy, and health. The state's plan is laid out on a new website, climateresilience.ca.gov, with specific action items and metrics for success. California's goal is to become carbon neutral by 2045. Jared Blumenfeld, California Secretary for Environmental Protection, says farm worker communities and low-income urban neighborhoods of color bear the most burden from excessive heat and pollution exacerbated by the warming climate.
We can turn this around. The intersectionality between climate and equity is absolutely central to the governor's budget. We just need to make sure that vulnerable communities are the first that we're helping.
The problem is immediate. The California Department of Water Resources just announced the current snowpack is only 38% of normal due to a record drought, also linked to climate change. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
20-year-old Alexander King has been sentenced to 16 months in prison after pleading guilty to setting a fire inside the Chase Bank in La Mesa. The bank burned to the ground during a riot on May 30, 2020. His co-defendant, Ricky Bernard Cooper, was sentenced to probation for 2 years last fall, with credit for time served while awaiting sentencing. That sentence prompted outraged comments from some La Mesa residents and owners of local businesses threatened by fires that burned down 3 buildings and ignited others. The fires occurred after a racial justice protest over the killing of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer who has since been convicted of murder. Protesters in La Mesa also marched over objections to the treatment of Amari Johnson, a young black man, by La Mesa police officer Matt Dagas, who was later fired and prosecuted for falsifying a police report, but a jury found him not guilty. Both Johnson and Dagas have filed lawsuits against the city, which has since adopted a citizens' police oversight board and named a new police chief who has rolled out reforms to help the community heal. The other 2 buildings destroyed were Union Bank and the Randall Lamb Historic Building, all near the heart of La Mesa's historic downtown village. The flames threatened to spread to other structures, with rioters blocking firefighters' access, terrorizing nearby residents who watched as flames engulfed portions of the village. Daniel Lewis Sandoval pleaded guilty to arson at the Randall Lamb Building. Zachary Alexander Karras was convicted of bringing explosive Molotov cocktails to the protest that night and was sentenced to nearly 3 years in federal prison. Police indicate that others involved in the arson incidents remain at large. To date, nobody has been arrested for the burning down of Union Bank, nor for fires set at City Hall, Vaughn's Market, and several vehicles that were set ablaze. Videos of the Randall Lamb Building, published by East County Magazine, showed several people inside as the fire was set, and some of those individuals also remain at large. Both banks have announced plans to rebuild, but construction has not yet begun, nor has anything been rebuilt on the vacant lot where Randall Lamb Building once stood. Anyone with information on arsonists involved in these crimes is asked to contact La Mesa Police or the FBI in San Diego, since burning a bank is a federal crime. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Marie Johnson.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is John Tidwell with a Crime Beat report. A prisoner who had a medical emergency during an appearance at the El Cajon Courthouse on Monday, April 4th, was taken by ambulance to Sharp Grossmont Hospital in La Mesa, where he escaped, prompting a search of the nearby community. 26-year-old Javier Perez had been arrested by San Diego police on March 29th on charges including child endangerment and felony possession of a firearm. While at the hospital after his court hearing on April 4th, he asked to use the restroom. Perez then ran from the sheriff's deputy, who was guarding him, according to the sheriff's department. The deputy ran after Perez, who jumped from a second-story parking garage adjacent to the hospital and fled off the hospital grounds. The sheriff's Astrea helicopter and the La Mesa Police Department were called in to help search for Perez. Residents reported hearing an announcement from the helicopter advising that a search was underway for a person in jail clothes. He was located in a creek bed adjacent to trolley tracks near the hospital and was taken into custody. The suspect complained of pain and was then transported to the UC San Diego Medical Center in Hillcrest for treatment. He is now facing new charges related to his escape. Media was unable to learn of this public safety threat in real time due to San Diego County Sheriff's moving all scanner traffic onto secure channels as of January 1st. So media could not alert the public that an escaped prisoner was on the loose near a hospital, regional shopping mall, trolley station, and homes. A bill in the legislature, SB 1000, would require law enforcement agencies in California to restore public and media access to scanner communications, except for privacy information, such as identities of victims. SB 1000 is scheduled for a hearing Tuesday, April 12th at 9 a.m. before the Senate Public Safety Committee.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
This is Miriam Raftery with a health alert. If you've purchased any Kinder chocolate products for your children for Easter, be sure to check the labels. The manufacturer, Ferrero, has recalled two Kinder chocolate products that may be contaminated with salmonella, which was detected at the manufacturing facility and has sickened children in Europe. The recalled products include Kinder Happy Moments, milk chocolate, and crispy wafer assortments with a Best Buy date of July 18th, and also Kinder Mix chocolate treat baskets with Best Buy date July 30th. In Europe, 134 children have fallen ill this year from these products, which were made in the same facility as those sold in America, though no U.S. cases of salmonella tied to the candies have yet been reported. Salmonella can cause serious and sometimes fatal infections in young children, elderly people, or those who are immune compromised. Symptoms can include bloody diarrhea, fever, vomiting, abdominal pain, and extreme cases, aneurysms, heart inflammation, or death. Consumers should not eat these products or allow their children to do so, and you can return them to the manufacturer for a refund.
April is widely recognized as National Arab American History Month. Both Grossmont and Cuyamaca colleges will celebrate the cultures, contributions, history, and resilience of Arab and Middle Eastern communities. Activities at Grossmont College coming up include presentations on Arabic calligraphy, artwork, and photography, a program of famous Arabic women, a tea gathering, a film on Syrian refugees in the U.S., an Egyptian celebration of spring, and an Arabic music concert. Cuyamaca College's happenings include programs on cultural diversity, preserving ethnic identities, an open mic event, social justice and activism through citizen diplomacy, and a presentation by Father Michael Bazzi on his new book about the Chaldean nation. All events are open to the public. You can find a full list of local Arab American Heritage Month events at grossmont.edu or cuyamaca.edu. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
The nonprofit San Diego Oasis in Grossmont Center in La Mesa has teamed up with Cox Communications to make technology accessible and affordable for members ages 50 and up. The newly opened Tech Tank at Oasis gives local seniors an opportunity to advance their technology skills and reduce social isolation, all to help bridge the digital divide among older adults. The Tech Tank offers technology classes and workshops, demonstrations, and one-on-one help. The Tech Tank has some services at no charge, such as one-on-one sessions for help with smartphones, tablets, and other devices. And you can choose from over the phone or in person at the Grossmont Center site. Tech demonstrations include how to use voice-controlled TV, streaming services, internet security, and smart home technology. Longer workshops are available for just a few dollars, with hands-on help for everything from how to use mapping apps and photo services to email basics, music streaming apps, Bluetooth use, QR codes, and ride-sharing apps such as Uber and Lyft. In 2020, Cox Communications donated $300,000 to San Diego Oasis to support the creation of the Tech Tank and increase digital literacy among older adults during the COVID-19 pandemic. Research has shown that older adults need technology not only to keep themselves safe and healthy, but also to enhance their lives by keeping them occupied and connected. Studies show that social isolation can be as bad for your health as smoking 15 cigarettes a day and can cause debilitating health issues in older individuals. So online learning and socialization is also critical for the mental health and well-being of today's seniors. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Marie Johnson with a public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. The Biden-Harris administration is announcing that more than 59 million Americans with Medicare Part B, including those enrolled in a Medicare Advantage plan, now have access to COVID-19 tests at no cost. People with Medicare can get up to 8 tests per calendar month from participating pharmacies and healthcare providers for the duration of the COVID-19 public health emergency. People with private insurance, group health plans, or state Medicaid programs can already access free COVID-19 tests under earlier actions by the Biden-Harris administration, which now has expanded that access to Medicare beneficiaries, including elderly and disabled Americans. This is the first time that Medicare has covered an over-the-counter self-administered test at no cost to beneficiaries. The new initiative enables payment from Medicare directly to participating eligible pharmacies and other healthcare providers to allow Medicare beneficiaries to receive tests at no cost in addition to the 2 sets of 4 free at-home COVID-19 tests. Americans can continue to order from covidtests.gov. National pharmacy chains participating and found locally include Albertsons, CVS, Costco, Kroger, which owns Ralph's, Vons, Rite Aid, Walgreens, and Walmart. People with Medicare can get additional information by contacting 1-800-MEDICARE or by visiting medicare.gov.
California colleges, especially 2-year institutions, are working overtime to attract more students this fall in the wake of a big drop in enrollment during the pandemic. According to the National Student Clearinghouse, California colleges lost more than 250,000 students from 2019 to 2021. U.S. Secretary of Education Miguel Cardona says enrollment plummeted by 1 million students nationwide.
With the steepest declines at our community colleges and among men of color, the impact of this missing million could be felt for decades.
A Gallup poll found that the adult students who had the hardest time staying enrolled are those who act as caregivers, are multiracial, or come from households that make less than $24,000 a year. Congress raised Pell Grants by $400 a year in the March federal spending bill, but advocates say those grants would need to be doubled in order to make a meaningful difference in college affordability. Dr. Raul Rodriguez is chancellor of the San Jose Evergreen Community College District. He says schools are partnering with employers to create programs that will lead directly to good jobs, and they're making college more accessible.
One of the things that we committed to early on was reaching out to the students we lost, calling them and find out what's going on, how can we help you. As well, this year we haven't charged students for tuition, and we're continuing that through next fall.
Many schools are trying to make courses more attractive to working adults by offering more online courses, even making lectures viewable after the fact, a trend called asynchronous scheduling. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The County of San Diego Department of Environmental Health and Quality has issued a boil water order for the Potrero County Park water system in Potrero. The drinking water system has tested positive for E. coli. E. coli may pose a special health risk for infants, young children, elderly, and people with severely compromised immune systems. The boil water order will remain in effect until lab results confirm absence of bacteria in the water supply. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Back in 2011, the city of Lemon Grove cut its recreation department and all recreation programs that did not recover costs due to a budget crisis. Current council members Jerry Jones and George Gastill were on the council then, and both voted against the cuts, which were approved by a slim 3-2 margin. Since then, the only rec center program outside of school hours is a Pee-wee sports program for kids ages 2 to 10, run by Mark Horton, a high school special education teacher. Standing outside the rec center, Horton says he's helping around 120 kids with his weekend program, but says this could help thousands every day. Originally, his program was supposed to be temporary, but more than 10 years later, the rec center is still closed. But now the Lemon Grove Rec Center may soon reopen, at least part-time. Community requests to reopen the facility have been consistent across public forums for years. They have grown louder in recent months, and strong collaboration with the city appears to be on the horizon. The push to try new collaborations with the city started after resident Penny Martinez offered grant writing assistance to the city council. Councilmember Jennifer Mendoza helped facilitate a community meeting on Friday, March 25th, to strategize funding and programming possibilities. Councilmember Liana LeBaron, who has long pushed to add reopening the rec center to the council agenda, also participated, as did 20 residents. Those present voiced their hopes to reestablish a positive recreation space for their kids, also voicing concerns about reopening safely, though the key issue remains how to help the cash-strapped city afford it. Grant writing, programming, and fundraising needs were all identified as needs for community participation. In 2018, the city council asked staff to project how much restoring certain services would cost. Mendoza recalls, "At the time, we really didn't have the funds," adding that a sales tax was voted down by residents and then the COVID-19 pandemic hit. 4 days after the March 25th meeting, Councilmember Mendoza says she met with the city manager, and she reports she was very positive about doing it. "With her on board, I'm really hopeful that it's going to happen." Brainstorming has already begun for a kickoff event this June. Some residents, in an email discussion on ways to fund the rec center, have suggested a citrus festival. Another obstacle to reopening the rec center is that Liberty Charter High School has occupied the space for years, but the charter school is leaving at the end of this school year, a decision made by the Lemon Grove School District. The school district built the rec center between two schools and has primary discretion of it during the school day, but the city maintains the building. With Liberty Charter vacating the space, now is an ideal time to partner with residents. At the community meeting, Councilmember Mendoza offered her vision for the rec center to be open morning to night on the weekends for public use as soon as possible, with more programs added later. She made clear, though, that the city would need to have an employee present for insurance purposes. The group also discussed trained volunteers as options. Councilmember LeBaron, who has been investigating what it would take to reopen the rec center since her time on the Planning Commission, noted that many new Lemon Grove residents have children and settled here due to housing being more affordable than in much of the region. "They're planting roots here, and now they're also expecting there to be something for their kids to do," she said, recalling her own childhood when the rec center was open for her to play after school. An open rec center would not only serve Lemon Grove's youths. From adult sports groups to casual outings with family and friends, the facility could once more be a resource for the entire community. One idea at the meeting for organizing the overall effort came from resident Chris Williams, who recently helped form a nonprofit foundation called the Neighborhood Enrichment Organization. He hopes to file a joint use agreement with the city so that planning for education, health, social, and skill training related programs can begin. Pursuing this approach could help sustain the rec center so that people like Horton do not have to do it all alone and without support. His time running Pee Wee Sports has been a success since the 2011 cuts, but he knows that many childhoods have already passed by without opportunity to access the rec center. "I'm not going to do it forever," he mused. "I want this to be open for kids." As he locked up the building after the meeting, he remembered how active the gym and classrooms used to be. He described ball games, arts and crafts, board games, movies, study spaces, flag football leagues, big dances, and festivals in the parking lot. "This was the heart of Lemon Grove," he said. Many who attended the community meeting grew up in Lemon Grove and knew the potential the rec center has to offer. With fresh communication between the public and the city, increased collaboration between council members, and the city's annual goal setting coming up, there is a real opportunity to start restoring recreational opportunities for Lemon Grove residents. Councilmember Mendoza affirms, "Those are going to be my goals. That's what I'm going to bring forward." Reporting for East County Magazine in Lemon Grove on KNSJ, this is Elijah McKee.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
You're listening to KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Bipartisan legislation co-authored by State Senator Brian Jones aimed at preventing the state from continuing to try to secretly place sexually violent predators, or SVPs, in unsuspecting communities has stalled this week in the Senate Public Safety Committee. Jones' Senate Bill 814, the Sexually Violent Predator Accountability, Fairness, and Enforcement Act, or SAFE Act, was introduced in response to the California Department of State Hospitals and its contractor repeatedly trying to place SVPs in East and North County, as well as other communities throughout the state. Locally, the communities of Mount Helix, Ranchita, Borrego Springs, and Rancho Bernardo have successfully fought to persuade judges to block state efforts to put SVPs in their communities, only to have them pop up again in another neighborhood. Jones says the attempted placements of monsters Douglas Badger and Merle Wakefield constitute a troubling pattern of the Department of State Hospitals playing hide the predator. He adds, these SVP placement games by the state's placement contractor, Liberty Healthcare, is not unique to the San Diego region and will probably be repeated again. Our SAFE Act would require transparency in the SVC placement process, force state officials to own up to these decisions, and make public safety the highest priority. Now, San Diego County supervisors have also voiced concern over the many SVC placements and attempted placements locally, and on a bipartisan vote, they asked the state to block further placements here until key reforms could be adopted, including advance notification of communities. But in the state legislative committee, Jones' bill received only a single vote in favor, with one member absent. SB 841 was granted reconsideration, so it can be brought up again for a second vote before April 29th. Specifically, SB 841, Jones' bill, would mandate that the director of the Department of State Hospitals publicly report each year how many SVPs are in each county and in which supervisorial district. It would also make public safety the highest criteria of any potential placement of an SVP. The bill would require the Department of State Hospitals to approve any placements before Liberty Healthcare can sign leases with property owners for placement locations, and it would require the Department of State Hospitals, the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, and CAL FIRE to report to the governor and legislature any inventory of state facilities that might be used to house SVPs instead of placing them in communities. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
As the Russian invasion of Ukraine generates suffering for millions, many in California naturally want to do what they can to support the refugees. But now scammers are working overtime to try to divert those funds. The Federal Trade Commission advises people to research the organization you plan to give to using sites like CharityWatch or Charity Navigator. Strat Maloma with AARP California says people should watch out for calls, emails, or social media messages that use high-pressure tactics.
And then they ask you to act urgently, immediately. There's no time to waste. And that should really be a red flag when you're not given time to do your research, time to think about it.
Maloma says it's helpful to even develop a little script so that you'll know how to turn down a persistent solicitor saying you'll have to do some research first or that you've already donated. The Federal Trade Commission warns that many scammers have started asking for payment in cryptocurrency, and Maloma says you should avoid making a donation using payment apps like Venmo or Zelle.
So if it's something like send me cash, send me gift cards, wire money, those should really be red flags.
Finally, experts warn that some scams aren't designed to get you to donate money, but rather to divulge your personal information so they can steal your identity and run up charges on your accounts. People who have fallen victim to a scam are encouraged to report it to the FTC or to the California Attorney General's office. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
She's a wife and a working mom. She is America at its best.
Georgia Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock commended Supreme Court nominee Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson as the Senate voted 53-47 in favor of her confirmation. When sworn in later this year to replace retiring Justice Stephen Breyer, Brown will be the first Black woman to serve on the nation's high court. Republicans continued to criticize her record. Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz.
Based on her record, I believe she will prove to be the furthest left of any justice to have ever served on the Supreme Court.
The House of Representatives is considering making changes to lawmakers' ability to trade individual stocks while holding office. Colorado Democratic Congressman Jonah Goose spoke in favor of the change to prevent the appearance of impropriety.
We are elected to serve the people, not stock portfolios, and that needs to change here in Washington.
The Kremlin admits it is suffering significant losses of troops since Russia launched its invasion of Ukraine. Russian forces are expected to withdraw from Kyiv and shift their attacks to the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with his NATO counterparts in Brussels, Belgium, to discuss the U.S. response.
We're constantly going over what it is Ukraine needs, what it is we're providing, what it is we're helping other allies and partners provide.
Meanwhile, the United Nations General Assembly voted to suspend Russia from the UN Human Rights Council over reports of what it called gross and systematic violations and abuses of human rights. Sharp declines in enrollment are forcing many community colleges to make drastic decisions. Executive Vice Chancellor for Policy and Strategy at the Tennessee Board of Regents, Russ Deaton, said schools in his state are experiencing enrollment drops not seen in two decades.
We're doing everything we can to turn that around. You're seeing our colleges be much more intentional about recruitment, both at the high school level, out of the community with adults, thinking much more deeply about how they better serve students.
This year, a record number of books have been banned or challenged in school districts across the nation. Advocates testified yesterday before the House Oversight and Reform Subcommittee on Civil Rights and Civil Liberties. Pennsylvania librarian Samantha Hall.
When books are removed, communities lose the voice that that book represents. Measuring the damage of lost voices is daunting and longitudinal.
I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Campo Day is coming up on April 30th, bringing history to life at several locations in Campo, including the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum. So we thought this would be a good time to replay our interview with the brakeman on the historic railway out there, Dick Pennock, on Sounds of History.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the Sounds of History. Today, we are resuming our conversation with Richard Pennock, the former president and CEO, founding member, and now the media coordinator of the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum Association. Dick Pennock, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, good morning, Helen. I'm glad to be here again with you. It's certainly my pleasure.
Last time, we learned about the size and operations of the Railway Museum. Our listeners can actually Google Pacific Southwest Railway, some variation of those words, and find you. But what's the main phone number?
The main phone number is area code 619-465-PSRM. That's 7776 on the dial.
I'm going to repeat that. It's 619-465-7776. Gosh, that's patriotic.
It is.
Sounds like the American Revolution. And it sounds like it was all the way out in Campo. You really have written the book on how to restore old trains and make them accessible to the public. Now, perhaps your most famous operation is that living history component, those weekend train rides at Campo. You are there as a conductor and locomotive engineer in full regalia, I might add. Do you still travel from Campo to Tecate?
We have weekend-only trains. We recommend that people check our website, psrm.org, to make sure of the schedule before they make the drive out there. It is a long way from San Diego, but certainly we feel it's worth the ride. We do not currently go to Tecate, and the reason is there is a railroad tunnel just over the international border on the Mexican side that burned and collapsed Christmas Day 2009. Since that time, the tunnel has not been repaired, and our monthly trips to Tecate had to be temporarily curtailed. So currently, we confine all of our operations and our special activities to the U.S. side of the border, between the border and Campo.
Why is the Campo train ride sometimes called the Polar Express?
Well, like all nonprofits, we do need to protect our bottom line, and we have many public activities, special activities during the year. The biggest one being our Santa train in the Christmas season. The first train runs the day after Thanksgiving, and we run 12 to 15 of those on consecutive weekends through the Christmas season. It is extremely popular, sold out every year.
At the dawn of the railroad, nobody had a union. There were no OSHA rules, occupational safety and health. So what were some of the dangers to, say, a brakeman on the railroad or another worker?
Interesting you ask about the brakeman, because on the railroad, particularly in the early days, that was one of the most dangerous occupations in train service. Now, even then, as now, you could get a job on the railroad in the office and never have to worry about ice and snow and sleet and storm. But the brakeman's job, before the days of air brakes, required that the brakeman, and they were all men in those days, had to ride the tops of the freight cars on a freight train in all weather, and they lost many of them in service. So there was generally always a job available, a job opening for brakemen, because the turnover was pretty high. It was a very hazardous occupation. Now, the passenger brakeman had it a little easier. He rode inside the passenger coaches normally with a conductor, so that wasn't quite so bad. But the freight brakeman on the freight trains, pretty horrible job.
Now, when people were riding the rails, which is the subject of poetry and song and folk music and all of the lore of the 1930s, really, what was that like?
You mean like a hobo?
Yes.
There were two different types of illegal rail riders, hobos and bums. Bums in those days had the same connotation it has today. Hobos sometimes were of a different cut. Sometimes they were riding the train illegally, but sort of looked the other way officially, because they were searching for work. They were moving from one workplace, one seasonal workplace possibly, to another, and many of the railroads often cut them a little slack and would not necessarily kick them off. They were all lumped under the term hobo, but there were differences. The bums often spent their evenings in jail when they were caught, whereas the hobos were, if you can say, maybe a somewhat higher echelon of itinerant society, shall we say.
Dick, the classic movie image is of a group of hobos. These are lonely guys in felt hats who go and offer to chop wood for a sandwich. They're all together in an empty freight car. They jump off at different points. Are we saying the wino, some poor tragic guy, is literally under that freight car? If we're riding the rails, we're so close to the rails, we're almost on them. Is that what that phrase means? It's a scary thing.
Well, not necessarily, but certainly there have been a lot of fatalities by bums, winos, others that aren't supposed to be on the property, going to sleep in a drunken stupor on a railroad track, which can be a very fatal exercise. It happens often on the Mexican side of the border, particularly at night. It even happens on the U.S. side. It's an unfortunate part of railroad operation. There are people that don't watch the crossing signs when they're crossing railroad tracks in their car or on foot. And in spite of all the warning signs and all of the measures the railroads try to take to promote safety, there
we
are still
tragedies.
Still
tragedies.
Exactly.
Richard, you have been intimately involved with railroads for all of your life, long ago and far away, as a carefree, wind-in-your-hair young man. Didn't you ride the rails? Have you had personal experience?
I did, and I do. Even in my senior years, I continue to have experiences that I cherish very highly. I will tell you that I have never had professional railroad experience. I get asked that question a lot. But I did try to get a job with the railroad in Oakland, California, back in the mid-1950s, right after I got out of high school, because I wanted to become a fireman on a steam locomotive. And unfortunately, the railroad was getting rid of its steam locomotives at the time, and they wrote me back a Dear John letter saying, well, we're sorry, but we've laid off most of our firemen because we don't have a need for them anymore. And I always look back on those days and wonder if should I have continued with trying to get a railroad career.
Were you hand-firing a coal-burning?
No, that was on an oil-burning locomotive. It would have been had I got the job. But I had that opportunity many years later when we founded the museum. But you asked about some other adventures that I have had over the years, and those have been many, particularly with regard to trains. And I had one, and I have to tell you up front, Helen, that this was strictly illegal. Do not encourage anybody to do this. It is strictly forbidden and against the law. But I was a young, headstrong, adventurous kid in those days, and I and others decided to hop a freight train on the railroad that we currently operate on, and we were going to take this ride through Carrizo Gorge and just have a ball. So we encamped ourselves on a flat car in a freight train, and we were coming back from El Centro in late afternoon. There are 17 tunnels just in the 11 miles of the Carrizo Gorge section. The first tunnel is protected by an overhead structure called a telltale. Basically, it's just a wooden framework with ropes with knots on the end of them hanging down about 3 feet below the top of this gantry, and it's designed to warn a trainman on top of a car that there's a tunnel or limited head clearance coming up. So should they be facing the wrong way, it warns them that you better duck because there's something coming up that might take the upper part of your torso off. So I was facing the wrong way when we were coming up to the first tunnel and enjoying the view and the fresh air in my hair. And all of a sudden, this telltale hit me in the back. And I immediately flattened on top of the car, and had I not done so, the tunnel was coming up in about an eighth of a mile, and I would have been a dead person. It was
Richard,
very hazardous.
Thank you for sharing that. And dear listeners, this does fall under the heading of don't try this at home, unless you are the body double for Sean Connery. I think we've all seen somebody, or Steve McQueen, fall to the roof, and suddenly there's a tunnel, and the audience is aghast. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Helen.
Dick Penick, this has been a wonderful conversation. I want to thank you for stopping by and sharing the lore, some of the lore. There's obviously much more from the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum. We didn't even get into the archives, and I know you have a big, big archive of precious material. Thank you, listeners, for tuning into the Sounds of History. I'm Helen O'Field.
This is East County Magazine's People Power, profiling local people making a positive difference in our community and our world.
This is Marie Johnson with the People Power Report. When Jordan Russo and Matt Lawrence met working at Chili's 14 years ago, they had no idea that they would eventually become close friends, roommates, and co-founders of an animal sanctuary in Campo. But after visiting animal sanctuaries in Los Angeles, they decided to open the nonprofit Farm Animal Rescue in Campo in 2016. Since then, the couple has had many successes, such as rescuing 111 pot-bellied pigs from a hoarding situation recently. The group helps relocate rescued animals to other sanctuaries and private homes when there are too many to house at their own facility. Pot-bellied pigs and roosters are the two agricultural animals most in need, according to Lawrence. People often buy pot-bellied pigs after breeders misrepresent how large the animals will become, then end up with 150-pound pets for which they can't care. Similarly, people buy baby chicks thinking they will be hens and are unprepared for a loud rooster that typically is not allowed in their residential area due to noise, so they look to rehome them. In Campo, keeping roosters is not a problem. Russo and Lawrence are fortunate to live and work at the sanctuary, though Russo also has a day job as a workers' compensation specialist. She works remotely, so she is able to assist with caring for the animals. Lawrence used to work full-time as a bartender, but when he got laid off due to COVID, donations to the sanctuary made it possible for him to switch to spending his time working at the sanctuary, he told East County Magazine, although he does occasionally work shifts with their mobile vet. COVID also caused Russo and Lawrence to transition from doing many in-person events, such as their annual open house every October, to providing virtual tours. They have recently resumed private tours that can be booked on their website, as well as hosting a public tour every month or two. The various species of rescues are kept in their own separate areas for safety's sake, with the exception of the Funky Bunch. That's a group of mostly elderly rescued animals with mobility issues, including several in specially designed wheelchairs. Their most recent rescue is a goat named Layla, who had been part of a 4-H breeding program and was scheduled to be slaughtered. After rescuing her, the couple discovered that Layla was pregnant. Her two babies, Betty and Sabrina, will live the rest of their lives safe with their mother at the sanctuary. In addition to around 90 farm animals that live permanently at Farm Animal Refuge and 9 pot-bellied pigs still waiting to be rehomed, Russo and Lawrence also have their own pet dogs and cats. For many visitors to the Farm Animal Rescue Sanctuary in Campo, it's their first time interacting with agricultural animals. Russo says pigs love belly rubs, cows play ball, goats love to cuddle, turkeys actually give hugs and purr. She added, once people get to experience that, they feel differently about farmed animals, and hopefully this leads to a compassionate lifestyle and diet. Both Russo and Lawrence have been vegan for over a decade and cite their love of animals as a reason for that choice and for opening Farm Animal Refuge. Farm Animal Refuge survives mainly off donations from private individuals, said Lawrence. The sanctuary does not receive any government funding because there isn't a lot available for farm animals. But Lawrence and Russo hope to get grants in the near future for educational programs such as virtual visits for schools. Russo's parents and sister help out at the sanctuary, along with dozens of volunteers who help with everything from caring for rescued livestock to fixing fences and building playgrounds for the animals. Anyone wanting to volunteer or make a donation can visit Farm Animal Refuge's website at farmanimalrefuge.org.
This is Miriam Raftery with a public service announcement from Senior Gleaners. A group of seniors picking surplus fruit throughout the county needs help immediately to prevent fruit on hundreds of trees from going to waste. Margaret Burton, board president of Senior Gleaners of San Diego County, says we have more requests for picking citrus trees than our current volunteer crews of seniors can handle. We need help to get the food to hungry families now before it falls off the trees and rots or gets put into the garbage, she says. Burton listed several reasons that volunteers age 55 and over have joined the group, such as getting outdoors, making new friends, keeping active, preventing food waste, and giving back to their communities. The group also needs people with vehicles that can haul several filled boxes of fruit in their own vehicle. Most deliveries are within 10 miles of the picking site. Most gleaners volunteer 3 to 4 hours, just one day a week, but there are no required minimum commitments. Volunteers join crews working near where they live. Some volunteers form small groups that work independently and set their own schedules. To learn more about the nonprofit and to register as a volunteer, visit seniorgleanerssdco.org. Again, that's seniorgleaners, GLEANERSSDCO.org.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine and KNSJ, bringing you some special information as we enter fire season. How prepared are you for an emergency? Just as you change your smoke detector batteries whenever you change your clocks for daylight savings time, it's also a smart idea to check your emergency kit at the start of every fire season. That means now. Of course, emergencies such as an earthquake or a blackout can happen at any time with no advance warning.
For households with children, elderly people, or those with limited mobility, being ready to take action is especially important. Updating your emergency list should start with a checklist. Did you add or lose any members of your household? Be sure to have enough supplies for everyone, including people and pets. Check the dates on canned goods and other perishables, and be sure that stored drinking water is still good. Create an emergency plan for your family. Identify two places for the family to meet. One should be somewhere outside your home, but close by, perhaps a neighbor's or a street corner. The other should be a spot away from your neighborhood, just in case the entire area is evacuated and you can't return. Using information from SDG&E and supplementing it with some additional tips, we've come up with the following helpful suggestions to be prepared. Practice an evacuation plan with your family, including children. If they get used to doing something when there is no panic, they will be much less frantic should a real disaster strike. Review emergency plans at your workplace, your child's school or daycare center, friends' homes, and other places where members of your family regularly spend time. Plan safe routes away from your home and business to high, safe ground, and be sure all family members know the routes. Have alternative routes in mind if the first option is blocked. Develop a plan for family pets and livestock, and have a backup plan because some evacuation shelters may not allow animals. Designate a friend or family member outside the area who all family members can call if you become separated, and that way you can know if everyone is safe. Have family members memorize that phone number in case cell phones die and you can't access the phone directory. Keep current important documents in a safe deposit box or send copies outside the area to be kept by a trusted relative or friend. Be sure that you can access your insurance policy and have a copy of your deed, for example. After Hurricane Katrina, when banks were destroyed by flooding and hurricanes, many homeowners had a lot of trouble putting in their insurance claims. Have a set place for your emergency supplies. Your emergency kit should include, at minimum, a 3-day supply of bottled water, 1 gallon per person per day, plus extra for pets or anyone with special needs, a 3-day supply of packaged, dried, and canned food that can be prepared without cooking, a first aid kit, and essential medicines for all family members, a pet carrier for each pet and pet food, a manual can opener, a portable radio, plenty of batteries and flashlights kept in waterproof bags, an extra set of car keys, credit cards, and always plenty of cash in case the power is out when ATM machines and credit card machines are not working. Special items for infants, elderly, or disabled family members. It's also important to make sure that you always keep plenty of gas in your car since pumps won't work when the power goes out. Also, be sure you have a car charger for your cell phones, since during a power outage, you don't want your cell phone to go dead. Car chargers are cheap, often less than $10, but can be crucial in an emergency. Know how to operate everything if the electricity is off, the keyless entry to your home, and an electric garage door and gates, for instance. Be sure you know how to open them manually. If you have a gas main, know how to shut it off in case of a leak or a disaster. Include instructions on how to shut off anything that's complicated in your family emergency kit. It's better to have supplies ready and never need them than to need them and not have them. SDG&E has also prepared some videos on fire season planning and general emergency preparedness that can be accessed in the Wildfire and Emergency section of our website at www.eastcountymagazine.org. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, Royalty Free Music, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.